Billy Jo, it's great, great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me. Good evening, everybody.
Oh, they're very polite, aren't they? So let's go right to the beginning, if at all possible. If I'm not mistaken, you were born in Chatham?
Yep, that's right, Chatham.
You're the eldest of three?
Yes, that's right.
Could you just tell us a little bit about your very early days and kind of what you remember of some of the earliest times in your life?
Yes, so I was born and bred in Chatham. The hospital doesn't exist anymore, but I grew up on a council estate called Melville Court. If you know Chatham at all, in the dockyard, there's a rather large tower block, and that was the council estate I grew up on. Early childhood memories were very much playing around in what was termed by us who lived there, Concrete City, playing around kind of climbing staircases, knock down ginger, those sort of early type games. But we lived in two different places within the estate, but it was an estate that very much, I was born 79, so this is the 80s, so there's a lot of single parents with sibling groups or one or two children, but yeah.
In some of our conversations and some of the things that I've read about your life, you've used the word chaotic to describe kind of your childhood and your early years. Can you give us maybe just a bit of insight into what that chaos looked like? I don't know if there are any particular examples that come to mind.
Yeah, so fundamentally what tended to happen within estates, as you see nowadays, more publicly and in the media, but it was an estate where lots of families lived on top of one another. And so to experience life within the system of benefits and bedrooms and things like this in the 80s was very much part of normal existence. And so we had many, many different friends. But my mum in particular had had similar struggles in her background and her upbringing. And these kind of transpired into her parenting, which without consistent building blocks for herself, meant that for me and my siblings, there were significant times where it was just very difficult to be in and around the home or in and around my mum, because she carried her own kind of difficulties and differences. But I suppose in the 80s, there was just a different way and attitude towards parenting, and the way you did that and the communities that you did that in affected how you parented yourself. Okay. So some of the chaotic times were earlier memories where my mum didn't necessarily have hold of her emotions, and so it was quite aggressive parenting. And our things, items in our bedroom and things like that would often be things that she would break and not be very kind to. But unfortunately, sometimes that overspilt to us, ourselves.
And we'll hear a little bit more about maybe some of those specific times as we go on in the conversation. Kind of as a result of the chaos or the difficulties, you were placed into something called flexicare.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that, because that's not a term that I was aware of before we chatted. I don't know if other people are familiar with it. But so tell us about flexicare.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I wasn't aware of that term until a month ago myself. And I'm sure we'll share a bit about that later. But it turns out that the system, social work system and the council in Medway had a system by where they identified families that were struggling, and they went into measures of where they tried to help the parent or parents keep the sibling groups together. And so I went into something with my sister called FlexiCare, and I was about the age of three. And this was a lady who would pick us up 3 days a week, take us to her home to play and to be with her, and then take us back home to alleviate the pressure for my mum. At this time, my brother had just been born, so she had three very young children very close together.
So the idea, I guess, was to kind of, to take you and your sister away, give you some space, or give her some space, maybe with just your brother, and recoup and get ready to kind of to have all three of you together. I think we've got a picture just to prove that you were younger than you are today. Oh, let's see. which is still very young. And you told people you were born in 79, so you know.
Yes.
So that's you and one of your flexi care visits, which we'll
talk about. It is, yeah.
Wonderful.
And I've only just received this photograph.
Oh, okay. Well, we will definitely revisit this picture a little bit later on because it's come to be kind of increasingly significant,
I guess,
in your story. But so this idea of you and your sister going to flexi care, giving your mum a little bit of space to kind of, I guess, have some capacity to parent a little bit more stably and more effectively.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily how she always used that space, is it? Do you mind me asking? There was a particular incident with a fire.
Yes. The choices we make when we're parents are sometimes done under really difficult situations, and I don't want to dishonour my mum at all in any way, because, you know, she is still around, and in her way was doing her very best. I was aware, and I have got a paper news clip where, unfortunately, the fire brigade was called to our home because my mum had left my brother in the house alone and was in the local pub with a gentleman. The social services then had a larger situation to be dealing with three children and this kind of chaotic notion of parenting. And I'm very aware that, you know, as public as that is, that my mum at her points, you know, why and what she made those decisions and choices for would have been things that she thought she was doing for the right, however, you know, weren't necessarily the right way to behave.
Totally, and you talked about that idea of there kind of being missing building blocks in her own development and development as a parent as well. I guess you can see that in some of those decisions, but
yeah.
Kind of an interesting, a challenging insight into what life was
I think socially as well, this being a council estate, everyone knew everyone, whether mum had got a neighbour to check in on us and a neighbour wasn't there particularly or had been locked out or, you know, there's lots of other things and scenarios around there. Neighbours always had other neighbours' children if people were down in the Pentagon and things like that. So in some senses, this was just general life living on the estate as well.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And yeah, I think there's sometimes a kind of a tendency to sort of grab some of these headline, you know, kind of incidents from someone's life. And I think it's really helpful to hear that other side and that there's a kind of almost a normalizing of it in the environment.
But, yeah.
So you kind of talked a little bit about this kind of the ever-changing nature of what it was like at home and obviously having flexi care every now and then and kind of your mum having a little bit of respite at those times. Kind of as a kind of trying to fill in some of those gaps, you said that you got involved in gangs at quite a young age. Can you, as someone who's never joined a gang, at least not knowingly, tell us... tell me if you know otherwise.
How
does that work?
Well, you make a really, really good point, actually, there, Luke, in that I didn't knowingly join a gang either. Mm. What I did start to do was errands and jobs, but that was around about the age 8 or 9. I started smoking when I was about 8, so I would have done little jobs and chores for particular members on the estate to get money for cigarettes.
Okay. And how does that evolve into something that, you know, because I'm assuming that that's not how your gang involvement continued through the years. How does that evolve to something, or what stage did you become aware, I'm in a gang or I'm involved in something that's kind of more sinister?
Yeah, I mean, so... For me, how it began was, you know, small envelopes, some of the older, bigger guys from the estate, and some of the women particularly as well, targeted us younger ones because it was cheaper and easier to pay me 50p to deliver an envelope to door number, I won't say, in case they still live there. Then it was to get some of the... soldiers and things to do it because it could have cost anything from between £15 to £20 to get a soldier to do it, or it would have been more kind of drugs involvement if you were to get a soldier. So us runners were very young and would do it. And it was through that that you started to begin to get kind of like this appeasement and taste of belonging and gangs and gang criminality, and those who mastermind gangs are really, really clever manipulators. So they begin to work away at this notion of, oh, you've done really well, next time maybe you could earn this. And when you are on benefits and mum doesn't really necessarily have the funds or the money to kind of give you pocket money and things, money becomes really important and an important manipulating tool. So between the ages of kind of 8, 9, I remember it ramping up significantly when I was 11, 12. And at that point, kind of male relationships and things like that were starting to form as well with really unstable people. But again, it was all that part of just wanting to be loved, cared for, and looked after. And a gang, when they do that, and they do that well, that's the place you want to be and the people you want to be around. So I didn't really necessarily know at that point either, Luke, that I was in a gang.
Wow.
They were my mates.
Yeah. That's incredible how you kind of get drawn in and how there's almost a bigger current of intentionality, but you as a kind of recipient or target are just sucked in.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that sense of belonging and how maybe that kind of started to unravel a little bit later on in life. But tell me, so you mentioned being 11, obviously this starts when you're kind of 8 or 9, you're running really small errands. Going to secondary school was kind of a significant marker for you. Why was that?
So literally my secondary school was across a great big field called the Great Lines now. It's a big memorial in Chatham. And that's one, primary school was one side, secondary school was the other side. And when you go to secondary school, the people who go with you would have been your friends and that from the estate. Well, a lot of them were the gang members. So secondary school is a place to make yourself and mark yourself. And when you're in a gang and you do that regularly on the estate, you've got the skills to transfer over to primary school. And I'd begun to already learn how to defend myself. And we didn't necessarily have knife crime as we have it now in the media and in our local towns and boroughs. But we did, there were particular people who would carry knives. That was never me, although I did remember having to defend myself once later in my teens. Significant people. So one of the gang members was in year 10 and they were carrying knives. So they were ready to work you in the school system.
Wow.
So you already went. So when I was 11, it ramped up both in the knowledge that this was now not just at home and in the estate, but this was happening in school and education, and I began to start using drugs.
And at the same time, so there's, you know, there's this group of people that you've gone to secondary school with and who are already in that system that are kind of working you in the system, but at the same time you're interfacing with people of very different lives.
Yeah.
So what was that like, a kind of realising that there was a broader world out there than the council?
Yeah, it's quite significant when you start to mix with other people that aren't necessarily just from the estate or the kind of benefits type culture that I'd always been in and around and experienced. Suddenly, I started making friends with there's about 5 of us in total. 2 of them had married parents, and they did this thing called going on holiday. I was like, what's that? Yeah. I quite like the idea of that. And so my understanding of the world grew significantly through making new friends.
And how did that have an impact on kind of life at home? Because obviously there's a kind of a broadening horizon, but the immediate circumstance isn't changing. How did that play out for you at those stages?
These are probably the most times I remember being in my room contemplating. A lady on our estate, Peggy, had scooped us up and would take a few of the estate kids to a church. And they gave us a pink Bible with funny little cartoon character people in it. And I distinctively remember that there would have been times of confusion where I remember oddly going to this book and then finding things that I could complain about. So it would say, you know, he is your rescuer. I'd be like, really?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I remember starting to ask questions like, okay, so if this isn't normal, what's other people's normal? Yeah. How does, and then why am I here? Why am I experiencing this and can't get out of this? And I'd go to stay at their house at the weekend and their mum and dad were lovely. And it just suddenly things began to be very unclear for me.
Mm. And I guess that there's a kind of a recurring theme that maybe comes to a head a little bit in an incident that happens a bit later, but this sense of in exploring some of those freedoms or wanting to spend time with friends that you knew from different kind of walks of life through school, that impacted your relationship with your mum further?
Yeah, and I think this is probably where I start to grow into my own person and my own understanding of who I might like to be, and I was drawing away from the family unit per se, and therefore not around as often to look after my brother and my sister. But there was quite chaotic times in that my mum wouldn't have been around, and so I was caring for my brother and my sister at that time as well. But I wanted to go and spend more time with my friends in their really nice houses with their nice parents, and one of the families had taken me on a holiday, which was, you know, quite exciting. But the more I was trying to be around other people with positive situations, the less I was at home.
Mm.
And that impact meant that no one was around to look after my sister or my brother, or my mum had to be there more and more. I kind of understand now that I've got a 16-year-old myself that also there might have been this desire to kind of hold on to the known, but never, you know, I still know I've got to let her go.
Yeah.
So one afternoon in particular, I asked my mum if I could go and stay at my boyfriend's. I was 15 at this time, and said, can I go and stay at my boyfriend's? And I'd been out quite significantly most weekends, and she had said, you know, no, I would like you to stay at home. I don't ever remember challenging her until this point where I just said that was really unfair. Mm. And my mum then got very, very unkind and was significantly violent towards me. And I do really remember thinking, no one's going to come. No one's going to get me out of this. Mm. I had to go to school, and it was quite clear that my mum had been very violent. And when I arrived at school, the social worker was already waiting. My mum had self-reported, and so the social worker was waiting with a head teacher already. And they had to take me back home because I was still a minor, and we needed to work this out, and the police needed to be involved because of the significance of the abuse. I starkly remember how scared I was to go back home, because I'd had to walk from home to school and knew that I'd had to walk into school in the clothes that I was wearing, and they were quite bloody. And when I went back to the house with the police officer, I remember sitting on the ends of my beds where I'd done years of this contemplating and, you know, deep thinking about how life was treating me, yet what the dreams I had. And the police officer and the social worker gave me a few options. I had to make a decision at the age of 15 whether to have my mum arrested and my sister and my brother and myself be taken back into care. I would have not found a foster home. I would have found an institution, possibly, which back in the 80s and 90s we knew were not the places to be. And I'd already kind of experienced this chaotic gang background as well. And my sister and my brother were, there's 2 years between us all, so they were early teens. It would have been very unlikely that they would have found homes to go to. Or being so close to 16, because I was about 15 and a half, stay at the house and wait it out until I was old enough to leave legally. So they were the choices I was given.
At 15?
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things that we haven't picked up a thread, but this, you know, this responsibility of caring for your two younger siblings, and I guess it was that influence and that responsibility that led to you staying in that environment.
Yeah, I decided to stay because I couldn't see my brother and my sister taken into care.
And what was that like? You know, you've had this awful experience with your mother, you know, nothing that a child should have to encounter from a parent, but yet you stayed under the same roof.
Yeah, it starkly changed things. My fear level was has never gone away. I think that's right to say. I'm terrified of my mum, unfortunately. Yeah. But we've never had a conversation about it. Yeah. So until such time we can, that fear is real. Yeah. And I did what I did to get through, to get by, and you know, get myself into a situation that I could leave as soon as I possibly could, where my sister and my brother were going to be safe. Mm.
Mm. So you stuck it out, you did your GCSEs.
Yeah, realised that probably education was the only way I was going to get out of the situation, to get a good job. I had really ludicrous dreams of getting out, getting a job, being able to buy a house, move my brother and my sister in with me. You know, and those sorts of things were the things that meant I just knuckled down. But I was living two lives, so school changed, and I was knuckling down to get my GCSEs. But home, gang, all of that hadn't. And by this point, even more significant men were in and around my life. It's not easy for me to say that married men and things like that were all a part of that. Mm. But they paved the way, they paid money and, you know, looked after me.
So we fast forward a little bit. There's these continuing streams. So education, you went on to study, was it childcare at college?
Yeah, I was really lucky.
Yeah, and the gang stuff continues as well while you're at college. So two lives kind of running simultaneously.
Yes,
is that
and
fair?
I very much felt that. Yeah. Every time I left the estate, I knew I was leaving to kind of be in a different world, and then I'd be on the bus going back to the estate, yeah, kind of like, okay, well, how am I going to flip between the two? But I had started to try to withdraw from the gang at this point, which was not made easy at all whatsoever. In particular, my very best friend became a target for quite significant abuse, and our house and things like that were bombed and all sorts.
And that came to a head, this idea of kind of trying to leave and just how stuck you were when you were arrested?
I'd been arrested significant times,
yeah. But there was, yeah, a
but
particular...
But definitely, yeah, by yeah. 17, I remember being at my then fiancé's house and my mum ringing to say, you know, politely, I'll put it politely, police have been at the door, they're coming to find you. Mm. Get back here now. But they did find me at my fiance's house. But I had started to sort out the chaos about 2 years before then. I had a really good job and started to kind of sort of get myself past that. But unfortunately, crimes that followed me through to 17 meant I was arrestable at 17. Mm. So yeah, I was arrested, which isn't fun.
So what happened then? What followed that arrest at 17?
Yeah, so from that arrest, I actually pleaded not guilty to the crimes that they had put before me because I wasn't guilty of them. It was some of the gang members had kind of set me up to trip me up and to get me into trouble. And sometimes the hope was that when you got gang members who were a bit flaky like me, because I knew too much as well. I knew too many secrets, so they try to make life very difficult for you so that you either stay in loyalty to them or you go to prison, but then they can get you in the system. So again, they turn manipulation into fear. So if they make you scared of them, then you'll stay loyal to them. But because I pled not guilty, the whole thing had to go through significant court system, and they were intimidating witnesses and things like this. So it went to Maidstone. It took 3 years from conviction to from arrest to conviction because of lots of things that they were up to. But I was convicted at 20 of some of these crimes by jury. And I, rather than going to a young offenders local to us, there was no space. I went to Colchester. And I can definitely see the grace of God in that. Because I went to Colchester, they couldn't get me, they didn't have anybody there. And I got to do my 4 months in private, no one visited. There was no way that they could connect to me at all.
So this was kind of the first time that you'd really been removed, although kind of prison sounds like a weird place for that to happen, that the first time you were removed from this kind of chaotic, kind of toxic environment.
Yeah, and stability enters your life at a really odd stage with prison, because suddenly it's all mapped out for you. And so all of that chaos and all of that kind of being able to do your own thing, intimidated by people, influenced by people, fear of people, suddenly that all goes and you're on this rotor and this timetable of 23 hours pretty much locked up with an hour in the yard if you've been good enough.
And I mean, I've visited prisons. I've always had the freedom to leave at the end of the day. 4 months in prison, can you give us a bit of an insight into what that's like, kind of emotionally, but also kind of physically and soul-searching wise?
Oh, you've got a lot of time to do that. A lot of time to sit and soul-search. Prison and the experience of going into prison itself is absolutely terrifying, because it's the unknown. I'd never been, I'd never visited. I knew plenty of people who had, and plenty of people who would talk about it, either positively or negatively. But the journey from Maidstone to Colchester, sitting in what is literally a tiny box with a window for I only know them as screws, sorry. Prison officers, thank you. I'm really sorry, I lost that.
If you're a prison officer here today,
really
please
sorry.
Don't be offended.
Sorry, it's ingrained. That's how they refer to themselves as well. So I apologise to anyone if I've offended.
Yeah.
So that in itself...
So the journey there was significant.
Yeah, and when you arrive, it is as scary as you do see it in the films. Yeah. You arrive, they're firm, you have to undress and change, and they're in the room. Yeah. There is no, it's a real kind of, yeah.
And we're going to stop a moment for an interval, but just before that, we're kind of going to cover a few things before we do that. You mentioned, no contact, no one wrote, whatever. To go back, you were saying belonging to a gang gave a sort of sense of belonging. But I guess being inside maybe exposed the superficiality of that.
Absolutely. Some people did kind of message and write. My family did visit once, but it was a long way to come. It's a really interesting time, and I remember meeting lots of different people while I was in there, and I mean, I thought I'd known the worst. Mm. I knew nothing. Mm. People inside of prison were, blew away the experiences I had moved from, and there I was thinking that my kind of experience was the worst it could be. Inside prison, you meet some really broken, hurt people, and it shocked me that in some senses I was all right, and that really, really impacted me. I thought, my goodness, some people have this far worse. And by this point I had got clean, so I didn't have to do the rehab that I saw people going through. I didn't necessarily see the self-harming. I didn't go down that route that I then saw inside prison on the bodies of some of the young women.
Yeah.
And I was the oldest, because a young offender is anyone under the age of 21.
Yeah.
So I was 20. You know, I was quite old, so I saw some really broken 12, 13, 14-year-olds in there. And right. I had an opportunity to be their friend.
Right.
And I did something very interesting while I was in there. I was asked to be a part of the task team who are put together to not frighten, but we're told we've got to frighten them and put them off of pre-offenders.
Mm-hmm.
So a group of pre-offenders come in and it's your job to basically scare them, to stop them doing the crimes that they're doing, to come to prison. And I found that really uncomfortable. I found it really difficult and
You're too nice, weren't you? That's the problem.
No, I really did because I then this is where I began to see how much I had changed.
Yeah.
Because several years before then, I would have had a fight if you'd looked at me.
Yeah.
I would have been like, you know, I would have been off the wall and that wouldn't have, but to then actively try and put that on, it went completely against how
kind of
I'd
felt
grown.
Like you significantly moved on from that stage in life. Yeah. So you did four months kind of remarkably well and were kind of very well behaved.
I was a good girl.
Which is great.
When you've not been a good girl.
Well done. Delayed, but well done. And so you came out on probation, which is a massive challenge in itself. Tell us very quickly about why that was a challenge and then we'll stop for a break and then we'll pick up the story after the intro.
You have to have an address to go to, and the only address I had could go back to was my mum's. So I went on 12 hours lockdown a day on tag in my mum's house, and it was the first time I'd been back to the house since I'd left. So, and then I had to finish the rest of my probation, which was, I think, 4 weeks. But I didn't finish the 4 weeks there.
And why was that?
Mum's control meant that she had control of me between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. I had a really good job. They'd kept my job open, so I was working during the day and out of the house. But 7 to 7, it meant my mum had me in the house and could do whatever it is she wanted to do. She didn't necessarily like that I had my adult opinions and things. And she tried to beat me up again by firstly beating me up and then dragging me out of the house so that it set off my alarm to have me rearrested and put back into prison.
And so you moved out of there, and then we'll hear after the interval that you kind of made a fresh start elsewhere. But we'll pick that up. That's just to make sure that you don't head out and you come back for the second half. But thank you so much. We're going to stop for 10 minutes. There are refreshments at the back. Please do refresh yourselves, visit the loos if you need, and then we'll start back in 10 minutes.